Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the CAF America Radio Network, a production of the Charities Aid Foundation of America. As the leader in global giving, CAF America offers more than 20 years of experience and expertise to corporations, foundations, and individuals who wish to give internationally and with enhanced due diligence in the United States. Through its industry-leading grant management programs and philanthropic advisory services, CAF America helps donors amplify their impact. This show is dedicated to these donors and the charities they support. CAF America is uniquely positioned to serve as the bridge between these important partners and transforms vision into meaningful action. Guests on the CAF America Radio Network are leaders in their field who share tips for success and stories that inspire. Our host is Ted Hart, the CEO of the Charities Aid Foundation of America. This is a live call-in show. Add your voice by calling 914-338-0855. After the show, you can find all of our podcasts at cafamerica.org. Don't forget to dial 914-338-0855. Now, welcome the host of the CAF America Radio Network, Ted Hart.
And welcome to this latest edition of the CAF America Radio Network. Thank you so much for joining us. We've got a very important show for you today. The two guests that we have are experts in their field. And specifically today, we're going to be talking about the post-sustainable development goals and the International Diaspora Giving Program. We're going to start off the show today with Heather Grady. Heather is Vice President at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. We will be discussing her role and the importance of the post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals in international grant making and the role that philanthropy plays in civil society. Heather has been tackling community level and policy challenges firsthand in East Asia, Africa, and the Middle East during two decades of development and human rights work. And it's my pleasure to welcome here live on the CAF America Radio Network, Heather Grady.
Thank you very much, Ted. Great to be here. Very happy to be with you today.
So these topics are just so massive. I mean, truly, literally, global scale. For those who are listening today who may not be as familiar with the lingo, can we start off with what are the Sustainable Development Goals, or SDGs?
Sure. So let me just take a step back and talk about what preceded them, and in fact, what the period that we're still in. We're working on something right now, the world is, called the Millennium Development Goals. And these really grew out of the Millennium Declaration, a very important document that was agreed to by all the world's governments in the year 2000 as the century changed. And the Millennium Declaration had very high hopes and aspirations for what would happen this century. In the subsequent months, staff at the UN and within governments realized that they needed to take this lofty declaration and turn it into something a little bit more practical and actionable, and came up with 8 Millennium Development Goals, so known as the MDGs. Now, those are 15-year goals, and they're coming to an end. Obviously, this year it's 2015. And so over the last, say, 5 years or so, really starting in 2010, 2011, governments and UN agencies, civil society organizations, and even business began talking about what should succeed the MDGs. And really, that was the beginning of talk about that. Some people thought it should be MDGs plus because the MDGs weren't reached. We have not had such a significant reduction in poverty around the world. We haven't met goals on areas like infant mortality or education. But others said, no, let's link in economic and environmental goals. So really the genesis of the SDGs was saying, how can we make sure that very important interlinked goals, social goals like health and education, environmental goals like protecting forests and attacking climate change, and economic goals like ensuring prosperity for all, that they were brought together. There's been a process over the last few years led by the United Nations and governments, but very much with participation of others, to really create these goals. And so we have 17 of them, and the final one is on partnership. They do cross these three areas, and I'll talk a bit more about that. But there's a couple of very important things. First of all, they include concepts like tackling inequality and improving governance, and also they're universal. And I think a lot of people haven't appreciated this, but every country in the world will be expected to contribute to achieving sustainable development for their own people and for people across the world. Thanks.
And when you mentioned there's 17 goals and post 2015, so moving beyond the MDGs, is the general sense of building this new set of goals that the MDGs were not all met, that a lot was learned and this is the next generation, or because we didn't meet those goals, we need to rethink the process?
Well, I think it's really a combination of both. Certainly, the Millennium Development Goals, some of them were met and some weren't, but there's also variations across countries. And there are issues that have come in. For example, the data collected at the beginning of the MDGs, it's not necessarily comparable across countries, and some countries began later than others. So it's a bit of a fraught process to measure exactly how much progress has been made. But undeniably, there are lessons learned. And one of the most important ones is that when there are goals that are created at a global level and really signed on to by all governments and shared by others in society, it's a focal point for action, for really achieving impact on people's lives. We saw this in goals, for example, on HIV/AIDS or on tackling hunger. It galvanized the global and national community to work together in new ways. So that was an important lesson learned in terms of creating the goals, the 17 Sustainable Development Goals. One of the lessons learned in terms of improvement was the MDGs really became something that was discussed mostly inside the UN. And if you ask the average person on the streets of the United States or Australia or perhaps Kenya or elsewhere, a lot of them wouldn't know what was meant by the Millennium Development Goals. So the process, millions of people literally have participated in online surveys. There have been thousands of consultations across the world and meetings to talk about what should go into these goals. And so it's very different in terms of process and content. Now, where we are with the 17 goals today is that they're pretty much agreed. There was something called a zero draft outcome document that talks about the goals, but there's still a lot of discussion about what will be the targets within each of the goals and what will be the indicators. So there's still quite an active dialogue going on. But again, I think that the process of bringing different people, different kinds of organizations into this, taking it outside the halls of the United Nations, is really something that distinguishes this time. So from 2015 to 2030, the coming 15 years, there will be a very different process in terms of these goals.
So that sounds like a lot of lessons learned in terms of how can goals then be attained. So it's one thing to say that we have the new post-2015 SDGs, and there is maybe a growing consensus among a larger number of players. But then how do you then meet those goals and have more accomplished at the end of that report period than before? And it sounds that that's part of the learning process as well.
Yes, I think there's no question that it's going to be a challenge to meet these goals. And again, one of the there's another difference. I mentioned the universality. So in the past, the Millennium Development Goals were really focused. A lot of the focus was from governments that give official development assistance or aid to countries that are receiving it. So that was where the MDGs really came into play. In this case, we're talking about every country in the world getting an understanding of what the SDGs are and then making commitments. So if we applied that to the U.S., for example, we would say there would be that the department, the U.S. government departments that deal with health, with education, with urban development, and so on. Each of these departments will have to think about, what does this mean to me? If we are really supposed to reduce maternal mortality rates in the United States, how do I have to turn that from policy into practice? So I think there is a big hill to climb in terms of achieving. Again, I think the value of such goals is that it focuses a lot of different actors on how to collaborate more effectively together. And so that brings new opportunities. There is, I'll talk a little bit more about this later, but there are ways that many of us are looking at how to bring different actors together to collaborate on these goals just at the point where they're getting in their final decision phases and getting launched. So, for example, we've created something, a few of us in the United Nations Development Program, the Foundation Center, and Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors have been working with a number of other organizations, some foundations, the Conrad N. Hilton Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the MasterCard Foundation, the Wings Global Network, and then, of course, other partners like CAF and many others around the world, trying to build up a kind of a discourse and eventually a practice on how to make sure we implement these goals effectively. So this post-2015 partnership platform on philanthropy that we've created is trying to show the proof of concept of if we created a platform where different actors could work together, does this enable us to make progress on the goals faster and deeper? And, well, we think it's beginning to work.
Well, we really applaud you and the leadership that you and your organization have provided in what can be very complex solutions to very complex problems. You and I were at the United Nations together back in April where this was discussed among a lot of other topics. And you were talking about partnerships. You were talking about a variety of different players, maybe a whole host of new players that were maybe not as engaged with the MDGs as they would like to be engaged with the new sustainable development goals. And specifically, we were talking about philanthropists and the role of philanthropy. Can we talk a little bit about what happened at the UN in April when we were there together and how you see that playing a significant role going forward with the SDGs?
Yes. I think if I think of the two sort of sectors that have been less engaged in the MDGs, but are increasingly getting interested in the sustainable development goals, it's really philanthropy and then the whole social investment sector, impact investors and others who are thinking about how to use financial investment for social and or environmental good. The meeting in April was in a way a preparation for two meetings. One is the Financing for Development meeting that's taking place in Addis Ababa, Ethiopia, in the middle of July. And the second is the actual post-2015 Sustainable Development Goals Summit that's taking place in New York from September 25th to 27th. What philanthropy is doing now is saying our grantees are increasingly engaging in the SDGs way beyond the way they engaged in the MDGs. They're saying that our grantees are key to us, but we as a philanthropy sector can also use our voice to amplify what our grantees are saying, to share in what our grantees are doing, to make sure that we're creating an enabling environment so that philanthropy can play a bigger role in these global and national frameworks. I think one of the real challenges for philanthropy is we always pride ourselves on being very independent, being innovative. We have patient capital. We have risk capital. We don't necessarily want to fall in line with what governments or the UN is telling us to do. What that requires really is us thinking about different kinds of accountability mechanisms for ourselves. Governments are obligated to their taxpayers. They have annual and multi-year planning. But for philanthropy, I think, we believe we can be very responsive to immediate needs or to very, very long-term social change. So I think philanthropy getting engaged in the SDGs is a great opportunity for deeper achievement of the goals sooner, but also a way for philanthropy to reflect how can we do better if we understand the local and national context for the grant making we're doing. I mean, I've really seen this over the years, the grant making that could be better if there were a greater awareness of what the policies are in place that we have to think about as we're doing our grants. I think it would be really useful to have philanthropy seeing what each of us are doing together on a particular goal area if you look at any particular country, I mean, I'll go back to this platform. We have our four pilot countries for this are Kenya and Ghana in Africa, Colombia, and Indonesia. And in each of these countries, we've had launch events where we're bringing together different foundations and individual philanthropists with the UN and with government and saying, we're all working on similar areas, many foundations working on education, many working on health, many working on climate change. But we're not really creating the synergies that we could because there isn't one place where we're sharing the information, the lessons learned, or even sharing what we're doing our grant making about. So just to go back to how philanthropy has been a bit left out of the tent but is really moving into it, our colleagues at the Foundation Center have created a new website called sdgfunders.org, and it will be launched in September this year at the week of the summit, but people can go ahead and sign up already. But that will really be the kind of place where philanthropy can gather over the Internet and share and exchange information, both between themselves and with governments and the UN system.
You mentioned the independence of philanthropists and the historical, very individual approach that many philanthropists take to the projects that they get involved with. What do you think is the perfect ecosystem that would include and invite and engage philanthropists with all the other players? Or is there a little bit of oil and water here?
Well, I think the perfect ecosystem is one where every sector maintains its comparative strengths and advantages, but where there is more coordination and interaction, collaboration, and cooperation. I think there is often mistrust, and you know, we see that right now in a number of countries where the philanthropy sector is coming a bit under fire, just as civil society is. And I think that one of the opportunities with the Sustainable Development Goals is to say, this is something that all sectors of society can get on board with. For example, we had a meeting in Colombia, and one of the real one of the cross-cutting issues we tackled there was peace building and making sure that the conflict doesn't re-erupt in the way that and so that people are suffering less from those long-term stresses in society. The foundation sector, the government at the national and city level, civil society partners, and business, everyone was aligned in terms of needing to work on peace building. Now, that's a great way forward for different sectors to work together, even though the foundations will be doing things a bit differently from governments. I think another example is that philanthropy and foundations are often in the lead when it comes to piloting and experimenting with new ideas. We might think of some development activities now that have become quite mainstream. I mean, I often think of microfinance. But back in the 1970s and 80s is really when individuals like Muhammad Yunus and Fazal Abed from BRAC, they were working on microfinance in Bangladesh. There were others working on this in Africa and South America. And it was really foundations that put in the first seed money, the Ford Foundation or the Rockefeller Foundation or others, putting in seed money to experiment with, is this an idea that could really scale up? And if you look now, that was taken from the foundation sector very much into the mainstream of development assistance. We could think of other areas like coastal-based resource management, natural resource management, or even areas like legal aid support, or more recently, tackling climate change in cities, how to make cities sustainable and more resilient to climate change. All of these were ideas that sort of germinated within foundations and with their grantees originally, but have now become mainstream. So I think the ecosystem is one where different sectors learn from each other and leverage each other's strengths. And again, I just want to say that foundations, you know, ourselves, we don't necessarily have a huge amount of money to spend. Collectively, it's a lot, but it's rather fragmented. But if we're working in an area like education or climate change or environment, the amount of official development aid that's going in is far greater. If we can leverage what the ODA is doing, I think that's another great opportunity. But what it requires is building trust and a lot more communication and information and active collaboration platforms for that really to happen.
So one of the, for our listeners today who are typically grant makers or those who are interested or representing philanthropic support, one of the models that they might consider in funding international projects of this sort that would be in support of the SDGs might be a sequencing rather than necessarily going through the process of formal partnerships, which, as you mentioned earlier, the sort of independence streak of philanthropists might sort of bristle at the notion of being controlled in some way by other forces. But perhaps a sequencing, as you said, of being that test money or the trial money or doing some of the advance work, that there may be very positive and regular roles that could be designed of where philanthropy might be best suited.
I think you're right. I mean, at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, we manage a number of donor collaboratives, and I think a lot of organizations like ours do that. And, of course, many of your listeners will be a part of donor collaboratives. Probably what's the most difficult thing to do, and it can have very high impact, but is more difficult, is when there's one project or program that a number of institutions create together and then implement together. What is sometimes a bit easier is for a number of foundations, and I would include here working with business, working with civil society, working with UN agencies and governments, to have a shared goal or shared aims or ideally shared objectives that are to some extent measurable, and then contribute different both financing and perhaps non-funding assets contribute to that shared goal. That, I think, is a very good way in. So, for example, there may be a foundation that wants to work on education in a certain country, but they don't want to pool their funds. But the first step is really understanding what's the national education policy, what are my peers in the foundation world contributing to, who are their grantees, where are the gaps in the system? Where can we actually have systemic change, but there aren't enough resources going to it? I think it's that kind of analysis and that kind of action that is really going to get us where we need to be in terms of achieving these goals over the next decade and a half. And that may be the best way in. But again, in order to do that, one has to understand and where to go and get the information, because none of us want to have really high transaction costs in going forward with our work.
Our discussion today is sort of centered around the sustainable development goals and the launch of those goals and what this might mean to bringing true change to very important challenges facing our planet. What are the next steps in the ratification of the SDGs? When do they sort of become official? What should philanthropists know in terms of their involvement?
Yes, so in terms of next steps for the SDGs, there will be this meeting in Ethiopia in July talking about the financing of the goals. But no matter what happens there, there will certainly be a summit in September, again, in New York from the 25th to the 27th. That will be a very energizing event, I think. What I've heard is that there will be more heads of state and government and probably royalty, and I believe the Pope is set to be there. So a lot of the more world leaders than we've seen at one place at one time for quite a while, perhaps ever. And the reason so many world leaders are going is because this is seen as a very momentous occasion. I often think back, not everyone thinks this way, but I often think back to the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's a powerful document. Again, we have not achieved all of those rights, but it is it's a set of organizing principles for the world to work together, to think about shared responsibilities, and what we can do together as different parts of a whole to really create a better future for people and for the planet. And so I think that summit in September is a great opportunity to do that. We will be, for anyone who's interested and won't be able to be there, there will certainly be a lot of communications about it. And really, I would say the goals come into play in January 2016, and that's when we all have to roll up our sleeves and turn to implementation. There will be a lot of things happening at national level. Again, if I think back to the example of Colombia, that is one of many countries that has set up a national commission on the SDGs. For the first time ever, they're including philanthropy with a formal seat at the table, which is fantastic. That's happening in a lot of countries. We see the same in the other platform countries we've chosen, in Kenya and Indonesia, a much bigger role for philanthropy, which I think gives us a tremendous opportunity. That, if we do it well, it can really translate into greater impact for all the people on whose behalf we work.
Well, you really have been a leading voice in not only bringing philanthropy to the table, but also helping other players and those who might be involved with partnerships to understand the true nature of philanthropy, including sort of the independence streak that you mentioned earlier. What is for all the philanthropists that are listening to today, what specifically would you like them to be thinking about in advance of this 2016 launch when they are putting their plans together for international grantmaking?
Well, our partner UNDP has offices around the world, probably in most of the countries where listeners are doing grantmaking. And I know there it's a fair criticism to say in the past, all the multilateral institutions, the UN agencies, the World Bank, the IMF, and so on, may have seemed like closed doors and windows. I think that's really changed in the last several years, and certainly all of those institutions are now engaging more with other stakeholders. So I would say if you're grant-making in a specific country, do stop into the UN to get some information. They have amazing data sets. UNDP can in turn facilitate introductions to any UN agencies, whether it's UNICEF that works so much on behalf of children, or UN Habitat, which works on cities and human settlements. I mean, I think finding out the resources that exist is key. Looking at our website or the website of the Foundation Center, checking out this portal, sdgfunders.org, will be important. I think most of us, we check in with our peers, you know, call a few people we know, or perhaps use Google in order to get information about who might be the best grantees for our work. I think if we do it a bit more systematically and with reference, we finally have a framework, we can check it back against these goals. If we're funding an education, we should say, what is that government doing? What's their national plan on education? How can we support them in that? Or if we believe there are groups that are left out, how do we make sure that we draw that to the attention of the government? So I think we're trying to make it easier for foundations and philanthropists to engage in this. And I'm really convinced that by the time the goals kick in January, we will have a pretty good infrastructure set up to do this.
Well, and we applaud you for that. And, of course, our listeners can also contact CAF America in terms of putting together their philanthropy and targeting it around the world for tax-effective and regulatory-compliant grants outside of the United States. We were really very honored to have you involved with the International Grant-Making Symposium right at the end of April. And part of the topics there were in the context of the SDGs. What do you think was the biggest takeaway from that gathering? And that was a partnership that CAF America brought together with Johns Hopkins SAIS.
Yes. Yeah, that was a great event, and I really commend CAF America for doing that. I think, you know, effective grant making is not simple or easy. And I think we're all learning more about it all the time. And I think doing it internationally is even more challenging than doing it domestically. My biggest takeaway from that event, I was impressed by the diversity of people in the room, private foundations, families, corporate foundations, and then some advisors. And I think what was interesting is that there was a lot of interest in working on the SDG framework. And also, I think people, no matter which sector they were from, they could really see the benefit of understanding the SDGs and using that as a bit more context setting for whatever kind of international grant making they were doing. So I was a little surprised and very pleased by the resonance it seemed to have across your participants.
Well, and of course, you were a big hit and just added a great deal of very thoughtful energy to the entire gathering, as did our next guest. And Heather, if you've got a second, I'd like to see if we might bring in our next guest and just have you to spend a couple minutes together, because I know you need to leave. But do you have a couple more minutes?
Yes, I do. Sure.
Okay, terrific. It is my pleasure here to welcome to the show Alexander Dixon, who is the Senior Director of the Diaspora Investment Alliance. He'll be discussing the current state of diaspora giving internationally and the crucial role that diaspora giving plays in international philanthropy. He most recently served as the Senior Advisor to USAID, which he assisted USAID's missions and private investors with investment structuring and negotiations related to Power Africa. Welcome here to the CAF America Radio Network, Alex Dixon. And you also were at the International Grant Making Symposium, which is why I wanted you and Heather to have a minute together. So welcome.
I'm invited.
Alex, are you there? There you are.
Yes,
okay.
Here I am. Hi,
Alex,
you
are with us. Great to have you
yes,
here.
Yes, I am.
You and Heather Grady is staying on for just a couple of minutes. The two of you were at the International Grant Making Symposium co-hosted by CAF America and Johns Hopkins SAIS. Heather and I were just talking about some of the takeaways there. You were on a panel on the application of expenditure responsibility in emerging markets, and I wondered if you wanted to, I know you could hear the bit of what Heather was saying, if you wanted to sort of weigh in on the advice for philanthropists in that area.
Oh, definitely. I mean, I agree with her that, you know, it's definitely getting more complicated to basically carry out grants and to do grants internationally, and especially when you look at the expenditure recognition requirements and all the compliance. And actually, it was as she was making one of her comments, I've already kind of done one of the things she's recommended. I was recently in Kenya, and I did reach out to the local UNDP office and to the office there that's working with them on the Sustainable Development Goals. And it was a great meeting for myself for regarding the project they were looking to carry out in Kenya with the basically doing a U.S. Donor Advised Fund there. And we basically had some follow-up conversations, and they were very helpful in helping us scope out and planning our execution on the ground with the fund. So I definitely agree with her and have taken her advice before she even offered it.
Well, there you go, Heather. Look, you're already having an impact here all the way in Kenya.
That's great.
Heather, is there anything else that you want to share or ask Alex before we go on to the second half of the show and talk about the diaspora giving program that Alex is heading up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say one thing. I had the real privilege of speaking at the United Nations General Assembly a couple of weeks ago to a room full of government officials and some UN staff and a few of us from philanthropy. And well, actually, I think I was the only one from philanthropy, but many from civil society and business. And I did make the point that I think people often don't understand what philanthropy is. And it's important to remember that, and I think in the U.S. we think mostly of this model of relatively large private foundations or family foundations that are doing a lot of grant making. But there's community philanthropy, there's corporate philanthropy, there's diaspora philanthropy, and then social impact investing and online platforms for giving, a lot of different ways. But I think if you count in the diaspora giving, it's enormous and extremely significant. And so I think the opportunity to combine diaspora philanthropy with others of us that work in other types of philanthropy is pretty significant. So I was very glad to meet Alex at that event, and I certainly now have diaspora philanthropy more on my radar screen going forward.
Well, look, you've both influenced each other, and Alex, it sounds like you're truly on the cutting edge, and if Heather Grady says that's where you are, that's exactly where you are.
Oh, so, that is great.
Heather
to
Grady, Vice President at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, thank you so much for joining us here on the CAF America Radio Network. You have offered so much information about the SDGs and really helped us, I think, grow in our understanding of sort of this new atmosphere of collaboration among a lot of different parties and how that might happen, maybe in a sequencing way. So, Heather, I hope you'll come back soon. We appreciate all of your support of CAF America and the work that we do in the sector.
Thank you very much, Ted, and good luck on what you do. Bye-bye.
Great. Thank you. Alex, I'm really very keen to jump right into helping our listeners today understand what is the Diaspora Investment Alliance.
Sure. The Diaspora Investment Alliance, we're a program at the Aspen Institute, and what we've been focused on and what we've been looking at is trying to figure out how we can catalyze diasporas, both philanthropic and investment dollars, back into their country of origin. And a big part of the work that we've done over the last year or so has been going out talking with diaspora groups about what their interests are, how they're currently investing, because what we found, I mean, everybody's doing something either philanthropically or actively investing, about how they're doing it and then what the roadblocks are. And we've been able to define some potential opportunities that we're currently looking to pilot this 2015-2016. And one of the big initiatives that we're pursuing with CAF, and we're glad to have CAF as a partner, is basically setting up two donor-advised funds, one for the Philippines and one for Kenya.
Well, we are honored to be able to support and partner with you as you are putting this very important diaspora giving program together. As you just mentioned, you're piloting in the Philippines and Kenya. What's been the reaction so far from the U.S. diaspora communities in the early going?
It's been very encouraging. The Filipino diaspora have been unique in that they previously had a vehicle in place through a U.S. NGO that was collecting donations and dispersing them to local NGOs in the Philippines, but that organization stopped approximately 3 years ago accepting those donations. So with the Filipino diaspora, there was a lot of pent-up demand about who they can give to, you know, how they can give, and they were very much in a giving mode. So when that organization went away, they definitely fell a lull in the market. So when we announced what we were doing, everyone was very excited. In the diaspora, and there's over 2 million Filipinos in the U.S., spread across all across the U.S. from various professions, from health to technology and everywhere. So there was a lot of enthusiasm. We announced the event in Manila, along with the Commission for Overseas Filipinos, which is a government agency responsible for diaspora outreach within the Philippine government. And they were holding a global summit which brought together all the Filipino diaspora groups from around the world. And kind of the most immediate question we got was that, you know, when are you going to come to the EU? When are you going to come to Australia? We want to do something similar to the effort that you're putting on for the U.S. So I think, you know, definitely if we can get the vehicle started again in the U.S., there's a lot of opportunity because the community definitely sees a need and definitely sees a desire.
So building off from what's already been done in the past, sometimes that can be a plus and sometimes it's a big hurdle for you to get over. Is it your general sense that this is sort of like we've been waiting for the right vehicle to get this moving again?
Definitely so. And what we've done to kind of answer, kind of, you know, to mitigate some of the risk, as you pointed out, that we have taken a lot of the actors and executives that were involved in the previous effort, and we're involving them in this effort. So we're totally trying to not to reinvent the wheel and make sure that we have the right stakeholders in place to make sure that we do have the most optimal offering that we can make, and it's a seamless transition once the new mechanism is put in place.
Now, an effort of that sort takes a lot of partners and a lot of ingenuity and thinking. And I know a lot of the thoughtful way that this is being put together is the energy that you bring to the table. But you also have partners with Aspen Institute and Rockefeller, CAF America. What are all those players, and how are they involved, and what's that going to mean to the long-term program?
Sure. I mean, Rockefeller was responsible for you starting the initiative at Aspen last year, and they provided kind of our initial funding and basically funded the research phase of our effort. And that was very critical to us because that allowed us to actually go out and have ground-level conversation with the diaspora community and really understand what their issues were, where they saw opportunities, and what were the potential hurdles from a legal and regulatory standpoint. So with that information in hand, we were able to really craft and identify what the opportunities are. And what we've found out so far from the response that we received, it's been over, 99% positive. And that's just because of the groundwork that was laid early on doing the research, talking with the groups and so forth. Rockefeller played a critical role in getting us off the ground and making sure that we had a solid offering and a solid understanding of the market. And Aspen Institute, as you know, is a very diverse organization. We're kind of one of 30 programs, but definitely within Aspen, we have synergies with the Aspen Network of Development Entrepreneurs. Your previous guest, Heather, had talked about social impact and impact investing, and we've been working and leveraging the Andy Network as well to figure out, okay, how do we do impact investing and how can we involve the diaspora and what are the opportunities? So we've been leveraging the resources within Aspen and trying to basically figure out how we can not kind of duplicate steps and then kind of go from lessons learned. So that's been a huge plus for us. And then outside of the Aspen arena and outside of the Rockefeller arena, we've been able to identify kind of critical best-of-breed providers in all the markets that we've been looking to go into. We've gone to identify key partners in Kenya. We have Kenya Commercial Bank, which is the largest bank in Kenya. We have their foundation that's going to work with us. In the Philippines, we have the Commission for Overseas Filipinos that we're looking to work. And then we're starting to pick up one or two private sector partners that have basically come in that are interested. So it's definitely building momentum. And I kind of always said, the good thing is no one told us that, our idea has been crazy, but everyone's been kind of saying, hey, this is a unique idea, and we think that it definitely has market readiness. So we've kind of almost been pelted on a monthly basis with new opportunities that have come in where people have been looking at organizations looking to engage the diaspora. And what we think we've been able to do is define a means and a way to do that in a systematic fashion, along with best-of-breed providers like CAF America.
Well, we know we heard earlier that Heather Grady has declared you truly on the cutting edge and doing something extremely important, so we know that part's true. But these sorts of things don't just come out of thin air. What are the trends and challenges of diaspora giving internationally?
I think the trends and challenges, the diaspora definitely want to have control over where their money goes and how it's spent. The most, one of the critical things is transparency and accountability. And that's something that we've seen across the groups, and that's one of the foremost criteria is that they're like, listen, we're willing to donate, and it's great that we can get a tax incentive to do that, but we don't want to see our money used or misused in a way that, would be counter to what our goals are and basically or be used in a way that we wouldn't approve of. We want the most to go out to the program level as possible. So I think the transparency and accountability is one thing that diaspora demands, along with, all big organizations demand the same thing. So I think it's 100% alignment there. And then where we see kind of maybe regional differences is that a lot of diaspora say, well, I come from this particular region. This is where I want my donations to flow. But when you actually look at the areas that they're interested in, it duplicates what all the other, most major organizations and everyone else is interested in, which is, kind of education and health. That always comes through. And then we have gender equality issues and so forth. So I very much see the diaspora lining up with a lot of sustainable development goals, lining up with a lot of the foundation priorities. And what an opportunity that we see, and one of the things that we're trying to do is point out, is that the diaspora donations can be used to help leverage up and basically bring more dollars into existing efforts. So as maybe programs change or interest level change, the diaspora are always going to have a connection to that community, and they're always going to be involved in that community no matter what. And that's the long-term nature of the diaspora, which I think can be leveraged by a lot of organizations, which sometimes go through programmatic or focus changes.
One of the things that I'm particularly excited about, and thank you for choosing CAF America to be your partner in this area, is that those that are looking to support through this program, those who would be part of a diaspora funding mechanism, tend to have a very real connection to their homeland or to the other part of the world that they're looking to support. And that sense of community is perhaps unique among those philanthropists than might be with others that are giving to a lot of really wonderful international programs. So the energy and the sensitivity of this form of philanthropy is perhaps deeper than with others.
No, I think for sure, and Heather had kind of mentioned about the different areas, about, you know, community-based financial, the social investing, and I definitely see the diaspora covering those different areas in that they are involved in the community, they understand what the community issues are, they have family members that still live in the community, so it's a very real kind of personal proposition to them. It's just not about, you know, this is the right thing to do, this is about something that, you know, we have to do and something that I want to see done because, you know, you can't remove yourself and say you can't identify with the problem because one time you were in the community and you're a representative of the community, you understand what that problem is firsthand, not to have, you know, a school that is running, not to have a proper health care system. So the issues, as you say, are very real to the diaspora, and I think that translates back into when you look at what they're doing already and how they're doing it, they're giving and they're basically donating their time, they're donating their money. And what we're just trying to do is give them a better kind of formalized channel to do that. And then also potentially to crowd in money from other organizations. Because one thing I think that might happen, one of kind of the outcomes could be that a lot of big organizations will see where the diaspora are putting their money. Like, well, I want to put my money into this community. Well, let's see what the diaspora is doing. And I think that will kind of give you a leading signal about what the needs of the community are, is where those in the diaspora are actually concentrating their investing and their philanthropy.
Well, it's sort of like when you're in a new town and you want good food, you go where the locals are eating because they know where the good food is. So if you're giving in a part of the world that you're less familiar with, knowing and understanding where the diaspora giving is going and what they're looking to support may be a very smart strategy.
Exactly, and I think it gives a lot of, you know, kind of silent intel about, you know, who the worthwhile organizations are, because I think the diaspora have also kind of have a silent intelligence network to help identify, well, you know, I'm giving money to this organization, well, you know, Uncle Joe or Aunt Susie, go check out that organization, you know, just to make sure what they're doing. And, hey, if you want to volunteer, you know, I've given some money to this organization, go volunteer down there. So I think it has a lot of benefit. You know, we always talk about monitoring and evaluation. We talk about all these different things. I think the diaspora giving and their networks bring a different aspect and kind of a new component to that that'll be very interesting as it basically develops over the next decade or so.
And the whole notion of crowdfunding and crowdsourcing is talked about, you know, almost anywhere you go. That's going to be a topic that's going to come up. And what's happened organically in diaspora giving is a perfect example of that. And what you're looking to harness and provide tax receipting and, you know, regulatory compliant aspect to this giving is just a natural extension of that, isn't it?
You know, very much so. I mean, we looked deeply at crowdfunding and a lot of different models, and what the diaspora told us kind of across the board was that, you know, yeah, it's great that I can make a return, it's great that I can do this, but, you know, I just want to do good, you know. My number one thing is I want to see good done in my community and something done at the ground level. The return and everything else was secondary to that. So the idea of having a philanthropic vehicle that they can donate into where they can see the money basically being put to use is of tremendous value and tremendous interest to them. But also, it also provides a platform, and one of the things that we want to do with this is kind of create portals where NGOs, information can be disseminated to the diaspora. The diaspora can also kind of nominate and let other people in the community know about their projects that they're involved in directly. So a lot of people have said, listen, you know, I've been giving to this school, or I have a scholarship fund that I've been funding for a number of years out of my pocket. I know it's a great organization. I've been supporting it. I think there'll be a lot of kind of natural generation of NGOs and projects that have come from the diaspora community but have never, you know, been able to see the light of day because they've been small and very community-focused. But we're hoping to give the diaspora a platform not only for them to talk about what they've been doing philanthropic-wise, but also about the projects that they've been supporting. And maybe that'll crowd in other money from other institutions as well.
Exactly. What does the partnership with CAF America specifically mean to the Diaspora Investment Alliance?
It means it's great for us. I mean, it's been one of our key. I can't, you know, harp on, you know, how critical it's been for us to get up and operating, to be with, you know, best of breed providers. And CAF America provides us that best of breed provider. It gives us the confidence when we do sit down with diaspora groups and they say, hey, how are you going to make sure that this is legally compliant? How are you going to basically take care of the back office? You know, how are you going to basically ensure that if we give you money, that it's going to be done in such a fashion that it's not misused, that it's done in an efficient manner? I don't want to see a lot of my money eaten up in transaction fees. And we've been able to answer them wholeheartedly and even challenge them to go out and look at CAF America. We've looked at a lot of organizations, and we believe that CAF America is a leading organization. And when people come back, they say, okay, maybe I hadn't heard of CAF America or hadn't heard of the Charity AIDS Foundation UK. They come back and say, oh, that's a great organization. But even more importantly than that for us, as I said early on, one of the big questions that we had when we announced this is, okay, well, when are you going to go to Canada or when are you going to go to the UK? And one of the things we've been able to answer is, well, with our partners, we'll be able to grow. And I think that's a huge advantage that CAF America has brought us to the table, in that we don't have to go out and look for another provider or another relationship. We can work within our existing relationship as we plan to grow internationally.
And, of course, what you're referring to there that we've discussed here on the radio program several times is that CAF America is part of the CAF Global Alliance with offices on six continents, and a subsidiary of CAF America is CAF Canada, which is now available for Canadians who want to be able to receive a tax receipt and be regulatory compliant with the CRA, which is the Canadian Revenue Agency. So lots of opportunities for us to partner together and to work together. I want to thank you again for your role in the International Grant Making Symposium. We had a chance to talk to Heather Grady about that program and the partnership that CAF America put together with Johns Hopkins SAIS. What were your reflections on that day in terms of your own work, but also your takeaways from that symposium?
I found the symposium extremely informative, very, very much informative. It was very well put together, and I commend you and your team for having a vision to put together such a format, and also kind of the courage, because what I found about it, what I loved about it, was that it actually went into detail. It was kind of it was an Indians conference. You know, it wasn't like a Chiefs conference. It was like, you know, how do you actually get these things done, and how do we basically talk about some of the practical issues which aren't sexy, which aren't very, you know, riveting, but which complicates everyone's daily lives about how do you actually do international grant making? What is the legal framework? What is the regulatory framework? What are the workarounds around it? What you need to be conscious of, because I think compared to a lot of conferences that you attend, everyone kind of stays at 30,000 feet and talks about these ideas in abstract. But what I loved about the IGS, it actually went down to ground level and brought practitioners in, and I walked away feeling, you know, not only do I have a better understanding, but I also have a better network of people when I do face this issue, or when we basically do walk up on this issue, this is who I can go to, and this is basically how we can go about it. Because at the end of the day, you know, we're going to be judged on execution by the diaspora. And I felt great coming out of that conference that many of the issues that we identified that we were going to have, from an administrative standpoint, were talked about kind of in an open forum and, you know, information exchange. So I thought it was an incredible conference and very well put together from what we were looking to do and what we needed to kind of get out of a conference at this stage.
Well, and thank you for that. And, of course, we benefited greatly by your involvement in the IGS. And we've heard that comment from a lot of different participants. And I think it's so much part of the DNA of CAF America to sweat the details, to have the protocols in place, and to protect the reputation and the regulatory compliant and the tax receipting of our donors, that from our perspective, we wouldn't be able to host something that didn't give people a very granular level of understanding in how this is done, because it's not impossible to be successful in international grant making, but it can be darn complicated. Mm-hmm. And getting it right and making sure that all parties are protected and the outcomes are what the philanthropist has in mind takes more than wishful thinking.
Exactly. And that's why I think, you know, in CAF America, I think we found a very valuable partner to help us, you know, make sure we get the details right and have confidence when we stand in front of a group, because for us, ultimately, they're going to remember that Alex Dixon and his team came and told us they were going to do X, Y, Z. And I want to be able to have the confidence when I leave the room and when the money starts coming in that it's going to be handled in a way that's compliant and everything I said can come true. And I feel very, very secure that that's going to happen working with CAF America. And then just the resources and the network that you have to help us kind of bring this vision to light, because we are at kind of this leading edge or this new edge of this diaspora giving within this whole donor advised fund pool. And I think, you know, it's something new. It's not something new per se, but it's new in the application that we're trying to put forward about using it to help aggregate diaspora philanthropy dollars in such a way that can be effective, can be kind of tipping point for other donations to come in, and also can basically represent a sustainability portion, because one thing that we see when we look at a lot of the humanitarian disasters that happen, the diaspora never stopped giving. You know, after it leaves CNN, after it leaves kind of BBC, the diaspora is still involved giving, they're philanthropically making sure that their communities are taken care of.
That's a very important point. Is again, as we mentioned before, and as Heather mentioned earlier, you know, that long tail, that these things are not, you know, simple fixes. And certainly those who are part of the diaspora of whatever community. I'm going to quickly just share a quick reminder for folks. Alex, we only have a couple more minutes, so when we come back, I just want you to wrap up and make sure that everybody understands how the Diaspora Investment Alliance is going to roll out in the two test communities that you're starting out with, and that's the Philippines and Kenya. We're just going to have a quick reminder here.
Remember, our podcasts and archives are always available 24 hours a day at CAFAmerica.org. If you're listening today, our phone lines are open. Call in and ask a question by dialing 914-338-0855. Now, back to the CAF America Radio Network and our host, Ted Hart.
And we are back. We're back here live with Alex Dixon, Senior Director of the Diaspora Investment Alliance. We've got just a couple minutes, Alex, before the end of the show. Tell us how this is going to roll out.
Sure. And by the third quarter of this year, we hope to basically start our launch activities, marketing activities for both the Kenyan and Philippine diaspora. And what that would entail is us actually going out, marketing to the groups, talking with the groups at the congressional district levels, at the community, through the community organizations, kind of letting them, making them aware that this fund is going to be in place, this fund can be utilized by them, and really kind of go through a ground truthing exercise following up what we did last year in the research phase. So that the groups will know that, okay, come, you know, tax, you know, come into the year between December and April, this is where I can give my philanthropic dollars to, and this is how it's going to be set up to do it. So that'll be kind of phase one. And then parallel to that, we're going to be working with our local partners in the Philippines and in Kenya to start developing the portals for the local NGOs to come on to as far as information, making sure that their legal documents and other compliant documents are put together. So we're going to start thinking through and developing the actual system to collect that data, how it's going to be presented, the standardization issues around that from a data standpoint. So the third quarter is our kickoff point. for the DAF, initial DAF marketing. In parallel to that, we're going to start the systems development work for the NGO portal. And then basically you're going to have a continuous marketing to the first quarter of 2016 and third quarter of 2016.
That's great. Alex, very quickly, any of the philanthropists today who might want to get involved, how can they reach you?
I'm sorry, beg your pardon?
How can someone reach you if they wanted to be involved?
Oh, sure. I mean, definitely give us a call at Aspen. My direct line is 202-736-2504, or they can reach us by email. My email is alexander.dixon@aspeninstitute.org, and we would love
and
to work with
that's going to have to be the end of it right there, Alex Dixon. Thank you for being our guest here on the CAF America Radio Network. We are right on time, and we've got to end the show. Thank you for everything. Take care.
Oh, no,
bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the CAF America Radio Network. Tell all your friends and colleagues to check out our production schedule. Sign up for our free newsletter and download our iPad and iPod friendly podcasts at CAFAmerica.org. Thanks for listening to the CAF America Radio Network.